This is Vermont Edition. I'm Patty Daniels in for Jane Lindholm. Not every librarian has her own Wikipedia page, but Jessamine West is not your typical librarian. Or maybe she is, and she's just better known than most in her profession. But it shouldn't be surprising that Jessamine West's online presence is robust. She works for the Open Library Project, which allows people to borrow free ebooks. And the blog Boing Boing has called her an internet folk hero. This spring, the Vermont Library Association gave her the Library Advocate of the Year Award, in part because she influenced the selection of the new Librarian of Congress. The day after she received that award, Jessamine West talked with Jane Lindholm on Vermont Edition.
You're a librarian without a library in the sense that you don't have a bricks and mortar library that you work at 40 hours a week. So what do you do?
Well, like you said, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to be a librarian. Sometimes you work in a library and maybe you do or do not have a library degree. Sometimes you have a library degree and you do information professional work, not within a building. For me, I have a combination of jobs like many people in Vermont. I work for the Internet Archives Open Library Project. I work at the Randolph Technical Career Center a couple hours a week doing computer drop-in time and adult education classes. Got a computer question? I'm the computer lady. I do some writing for Computers in Libraries magazine, which is an adorably named magazine, talking about technology topics. And I do some public speaking, going to library conferences and talking about topics like the digital divide or social media for libraries, that kind of thing.
How does one become a celebrity librarian? I mean, you certainly are.
You know, the job itself, I like to think about it like many professions have sort of people that talk about the profession and people that do the work. And librarianship, obviously, I believe needs both sort of more than ever. I think one of the reasons we had a long-standing image problem was because we just kind of did our work and didn't matter what people said about us. We knew we were good and doing good works. But as, you know, media gets more 24/7, as social media becomes more of how people know about things, we've had to have a response to that. And as somebody who's tech friendly and library friendly, it just seemed like an unfilled niche to go chit-chatting about, hey, libraries are actually kind of terrific. And the more you talk about that, people pick that up, especially using technology like social media. And people know you sort of despite yourself, kind of. And also because I don't work 40 hours a week, I have time to bang the drum, so to speak, and tell the stories of the people who are working 40 hours a week who don't have that time.
Well, then tell part of the story about why libraries are so important and so relevant. Because, you know, one of the things that we hear is that it's the digital age. You can get access to information anywhere on your phone. You don't need a library. You don't need a librarian in the way that you might have a generation or two generations ago. But so what makes libraries not only important but part of that, those digital changes and the technological changes, not sort of here in spite of them?
Well, it's a whole bunch of different things. But for me, and sort of where I work in Vermont, like one of the biggest things is saying everything's on the internet is great if you know how to use the internet. People who say it's all on Google probably haven't spent a lot of time watching people try to find what they want on Google. It's challenging. There's a lot of syntax to know. You've got to know how to use a mouse. You've got to understand clicking. What's a tab? What happens when I do this, that, and the other? And there really isn't a social institution dedicated to helping you figure it out. And then that's just for digitally divided folks, but for sort of average folks who know how to use a computer, they still need to know how to be discerning about the information they get. Lots of information on the internet is trying to push you in a very specific direction. I mean, Google's the largest ad agency in the world. That's actually where their money comes from. No big deal, but it's useful to know that when you wonder why you're getting that result on the top. A lot of people don't understand that thing is an ad. And if we're a democracy, the important thing about a democracy is that you get to inform yourself the way you want to and learn the things for you to make the decisions that affect your life, not someone else telling you how to do that. And so libraries are neutral in this really interesting way and not neutral in this other interesting way, in that they really want to help you be you, not you be what somebody else wants you to be.
Why? Do they have access to things that I can't get just by Googling?
Yeah, and we call these information silos and we sort of fight to knock them down in the library world, but you can get access to history books as an example. One of the examples I use a lot is like try to find an obituary for somebody who died in the late 70s, early 80s. It's really hard. It may be locked up in a newspaper archive and the newspaper maybe would like you to pay a couple bucks for it. Again, no big deal. That's their business. But the library can help you find that. Consumer Reports, for example. My public library subscribes to Consumer Reports. If you want to figure out how to buy a vacuum cleaner, you can come there and get access to that thing that otherwise you not only have to buy, but buy something that was published 8 months ago. And it's confusing and challenging. But the library just has it. And the person who works at the library is the person who can tell you how to get it. And that's why it's sort of people plus data, not one or the other.
Or for me, it's been trying to find information about, for example, diseases or medical issues when you want to go straight to the studies, not to the filter of some doctor who works for such and such website.
Or even a website like WebMD who gets a lot of money from Pfizer. Again, not a big deal, but the average person who types in, hypoglycemia is going to find results from places that sell you hypoglycemia medicine. Once you know that, you can make discerning choices. Maybe you need hypoglycemia medicine and that solves a problem for you. But you should be able to know, like, the National Institute of Health and PubMed are going to give you one set of results, especially original research, which for people who really want to get to the source is important. You know, WebMD is going to give you a different kind of thing. The Mayo Clinic's website is going to help you do this, that, and the other. And the forums are going to help you, you know, go hide under your bed because you're sure whatever you have is going to kill you. And being able to make those decisions is things a lot of people could use help with.
We're talking about the value of libraries in the digital age with Jessamyn West, and we're learning more about why she says if you care about democracy, you should care about libraries. If you have a question for her, you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Anthony calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Anthony. Go right ahead.
Hi. I think this is a fantastic topic, and I'm calling to lament the closure of the physical space that used to be the Vermont Law Library in Montpelier, Vermont. It was a great library that had very helpful librarians. And in this age where there are so many people in the having to interface with the criminal and civil justice system without attorneys, it was a great resource for them. And even for people who are working with smaller law firms that don't have the money to subscribe to a lot of the proprietary databases where a lot of legal information is kept these days, it was just a tremendous resource to keep access to justice barriers lower. And so I think it's great you're focusing on this, and I can't say enough about how useful actual physical libraries can be, and the Internet is just not a good substitute.
Anthony, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Jessamyn, what about this fact that we do see libraries closing for lack of support and funding?
Well, and Anthony raises a really good point, which is that one of the other things libraries offer is people who need information for, you know, life-changing issues. Like, I have a legal issue and maybe I can't afford a lawyer, and the state law library used to be a place in Montpelier you could go and get access to tools and resources that you wouldn't have otherwise. There have been terrible, terrible funding cuts to the State Department of Libraries. Just awful. We're one of the few states one of eight states in the country that doesn't have state-level funding that goes down to our public libraries. And so the state has been getting more and more budget cuts, and they actually had to it's sort of complicated, but the Vermont Law School basically is where people can go to get access to legal information and legal help, but that's in South Royalton. That's not in Montpelier. There's no public transportation there. There's not the same crew of people to help you. And, you know, I believe it's sort of a short-sighted decision because what it is it's impacting negatively the very same people that those libraries are designed to help in the first place. And they don't Again, they don't do it on purpose. Like, money is real, and you have to make the decisions you make. But it is really challenging to decentralize those. And every time you put something on the internet, you're basically keeping it away from somebody for whom the internet is not real yet.
Which is so interesting because you also, I know you're an advocate for open source stuff and open resources and this idea that the internet isn't always open even to people who have access to the internet. And so if you're putting things on the internet in other ways, you are getting people more access to things that they might not otherwise have been able to find if, for example, they were only in that law library.
Well, it's tricky, right? You have to do both. And for a lot of people, they hear both and they're like, you know, more expensive. But, you know, I'm a person who bought my healthcare on the exchange, and the Vermont healthcare website where where you bought healthcare was challenging to use. Not an awesome website. There were lots of problems, but the people on the phone were amazing. They had the patience of saints. They were incredibly kind. And, you know, we only had 40,000 people signing up. It's almost hard to, I mean, I understand the economies of scale, which is why you would want to create these tools. But in many cases, the human touch to help people figure things out, a lot of what they were just doing was figuring out the website for people who really couldn't understand it because it wasn't very intuitive. And so any good plan to digitize information and make it more available has to have a human element to help the people for whom maybe your stuff doesn't work. There's no such thing as an absolutely intuitive interface, which is sort of my message to people who have a hard time with technology. Like, it's not you if it's hard to use. Somebody probably built it a little wrong, or maybe you're not their target demo. And it's useful to understand that as you struggle with technology, that there probably is a way you could learn to use it better, and there's a person who can help you.
We got a note from Owen and Margaret who say, we're new to Vermont, moving here just under 2 years ago. We love our new lives here, but we've been disappointed in the libraries. We live in a very small town. We love the small library here, but its resources are limited for obvious reasons. There's an interlibrary loan, but interlibrary loan is also a burden for the library. We wonder why Vermont doesn't follow a model found in other states, a state library card, which means that a citizen of the state can use any library. One other suggestion, we moved from Iowa, where if we presented documentation that we were Iowa residents at the University of Iowa in Iowa City, we were given a library card with borrowing privileges. Why can't we do the same at UVM? All state residents should be able to use this library.
Well, it's tricky. You can't do it at the University of Vermont, but you can do it in the Community College of Vermont system. So I live in Vermont. We have Vermont Technical College, which is a really fantastic library up on the hill in Randolph Center. And it's open late at night. It's got lots of technology. It's got free Wi-Fi. It's got a great lending library. And anybody who's a state resident can get access to that. And that's true for the entire community college system. UVM doesn't do it because for resources. And I do have to say, Iowa does have one of the better state library systems in the country. So again, we have a hard time with funding, and there have been priorities and choices. The Vermont Library Association and the Green Mountain Library Consortium are actually really trying and working towards a state card. Chittenden County now has a county-wide card that you can use at multiple libraries, but it may be that there's a small town near you that you can get a library card at for free. Some libraries have cards for free, some do not, that may fill in some of the gaps in your current library system.
We also have a note from Tom who says, the Burlington School District is planning on cutting library and media services by 50% next year. What effects will this have on students' literary skills, especially for English language learners?
Well, one of the things that we found, and there's data to support it, is that students do better in schools with school library media specialists or librarians. And places make decisions because they feel like, well, we can't cut math because you need that for the test, and you can't cut English but because you need that for the test. But I do feel like for literacy, both English fluency and computer literacy, libraries are really one of the places that people can get unstructured access, which enables them to structure their learning in the way that's necessary for them, and getting some of those computer literacy skills. And the big deal is for a lot, again, digitally divided kids, that's where they do their homework, because maybe they don't have a computer at home, or they maybe don't have internet at home. And any cuts that you make to that system are really negatively impacting the people who are already having a hard time. So I think that's very frustrating. And I keep telling people, talk to their school boards, that that's not where these things should be happening. Again, I sympathize with the people who have to make those choices, but I think it's a short-sighted one.
If you could recreate or sort of wipe our brains and recreate a definition of what a library is or what a librarian is, how would you define it? Because, I mean, so many of us have these either images from our childhoods about a library or a librarian, or, you know, a definition that's sort of been handed across generations that's different in some ways from what libraries are today. How would you, I mean, just create the definition. What's a library?
Well, the big change is the libraries are for books. I think most of us have seen that changing in our lifetime, that a library is a community space. It's owned by the community in addition to being for the community. I think the big shift we're seeing now is the geographic focus of libraries is broadening, that in some ways the way you have a farmer's market and you can get local food, your library hasn't always been for local books. But as more information becomes available globally, the internet, giant databases that anybody can have, libraries are almost refocusing on helping the community sort of – I think of them as sort of a place where the community gets to show itself to itself or look at itself. And the librarians are not just the people who are – being the information gatekeepers, as we used to say, and being like, well, don't really touch that book because it's fancy and you're not. But instead, hey, what do you need? What information needs do you need to solve? Here's some resources always set up, and here's a person who can help you figure out what other resources you may need. And we're seeing libraries nationwide branching out into all sorts of things, book delivery via bicycle or the makerspace movement, which people have mixed feelings about, but it has really brought a different type of person into the library, or English as a second language, which is huge as America becomes significantly more diverse, both with language diversity and people from other countries. So the best libraries are meeting the communities where they are and helping them grow in ways that are effective, efficient, and make them happy, and basically using the community's own money to help the communities be better. And the librarians are the people who facilitate and steward those interactions in order to ensure that they happen and ensure that they can continue to happen, which is the real key in sort of the battlefield that we see nowadays.
We've even seen libraries play a role recently in the last year or two, you know, as cities found themselves in the midst of protests, you know, at Ferguson, Baltimore, after police killings and some protests that erupted there, we really saw the libraries be a place where people were holding classes when schools were canceled, or even reporters were going for the free Wi-Fi because there were a lot of places where internet connections were being shut down and places were being closed. And the libraries were these sort of open resources for people in a way that I guess shouldn't be surprising, but in some ways was for people that, okay, here's this resource. It's still a community resource, and it's still open in the midst of all this.
Right. We may not have our power on, but we can have bicycles that charge your phones. I mean, librarians really rose to meet that challenge in ways that were impressive. Our speaker at the Vermont Library Conference last year was Scotty Bonner from Ferguson, and he really talked about, like, it's just what we do. We saw a problem, we saw a need, and we met it head on and handled it because it's our job, not because we're trying to be showboats or not because it brings us money, although it happened to for the Ferguson Library, but because this is our community and our community is hurting and we have resources and trust that people have instilled in us that we can now turn around and it's our time to shine. So Ferguson did some wonderful things with classes. The Queensboro Public Library after Hurricane Sandy, our keynote speaker Rebecca Aldrich did a thing about sustainability in libraries. They were on the beach doing story time for traumatized kids before the Red Cross got there. And it's just, it's a great photo op, but whatever. It's also just a really cool thing to be doing. Those people have jobs. Part of their job is helping the community in whatever way they needed. And what they needed after Hurricane Sandy, especially in sort of coastal regions, was healing. And they needed to come together and the kids needed something to do and they needed to charge their phones and they needed that kind of thing. And in Baltimore, they needed the library to say, hey, we're open for you and we're open for everybody because that's actually the community. It's easy to be like, well, those people aren't our people. They're not my people. These people aren't our people. They're not my people. And for people to grump, grump, grump. But one of the things I love about the library is they're like, this is the geographic designation and everyone in this umbrella belongs to us and we belong to them. Work it out. And we're seeing libraries being really effective at that. And it's very gratifying to me.
That's librarian Jessamine West speaking this spring on Vermont Edition. She says in the digital age, if you care about democracy, you should care about libraries. More of our interview is just ahead. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Patty Daniels. Librarian Jessamine West is a rock star in library circles. She had a big hand in helping to choose the nominee to be the next Librarian of Congress in Washington, work that the Vermont Library Association recognized her for this spring. Around that time, she was Jane Lindholm's guest on Vermont Edition to talk about why libraries matter in the digital age and to take a few questions from our listeners.
We got a note from Jeffrey in Grand Isle who says, Jessamine, a case in point. I'm working from home here in Vermont on a PhD on Freud. My school is in Europe. I simply need access to Freud's work in German, which UVM has, but I'm not allowed access. Can you make any suggestions? Thanks.
This is one of those really tricky questions, right? That information is probably on the internet, and yet you don't necessarily know where it is. My suggestion is to see if your library, first off, as the most legit way, can go get it, but also maybe Googling a little bit about how people find documents on the internet when they can't get access to them through their own libraries. Super tricky, I understand, but it's definitely a thing that if not your librarian, then other librarians would know how to do.
All right. Or, you know, maybe you can get a grant and go to Germany. That's what I would be working for. Bruce is calling in from Essex. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane and Jasmine. I'm on the State Library Board, and I just want to say congratulations on your award and also say thank you for your inspirational attitude about libraries. There are a lot of stories over Vermont that people don't often hear, and this is an example of a good one to hear, and I really appreciate it. And for the listeners, we don't have much of a state library system. It's local control, bottoms-up libraries. But in the light of the budget cuts we saw in the State Department of Libraries, we're trying to figure out a way forward. And Jasmine, please weigh in the future if you want and give us some ideas. But we want to maintain, with the reduced staff we have, a real, I think, service to public libraries. So thanks and congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Jessamine, the award that you won from the Vermont Library Association was Library Advocate of the Year, which is not given out every year, though, as far as I can see. It's sort of a given out when a case merits it. And so by your understanding, what do you think got you that accolade?
Well, I think the big deal, usually it's an award given to sort of government people. And this year or in the last year, I've been really active. I mean, I'm barely into civics in general. I mean, librarians are in general, but I really, really am. I'm a justice of the peace in my town. I marry people. I sit on the board of civil authority. I do all that kind of stuff. But I've also gotten involved on a national level because the Librarian of Congress finally retired after 28 years, which was a huge deal in the library world. I mean, it's one of those Halley's Comet type of things, not quite so much. But that offered an opportunity for people who consider themselves library advocates and maybe library activists to spend a little bit of time agitating to try and get somebody in that role who would do the things that I say we, but like librarians want. I mean, obviously that person does a lot of different things, but running the biggest library in the world, my feeling was that person should be a librarian. And so I took my sort of role as general internet loudmouth and started talking to people about what would you like? What do you think is important? What do we need? A lot of people felt that the Library of Congress had gotten maybe a little stagnant over the last while. How do we shake that up? Many of us know people who work there who say morale's been bad. And so spending a lot of time having community conversations, making a little website, agitating with the right people, having some important phone calls, and continuing the conversation on and on and on until Carla Hayden got nominated a couple months ago. I mean, it was so ridiculous. Like we were all live tweeting her nomination hearing like a bunch of goofy fangirls and boys. But it's a huge deal in our profession, and it's probably the most important job we're going to see anybody get in maybe our lifetimes, although now the term limit's 10 years, so maybe it'll happen again 10 years from now. But I think that was the big thing for this award, in that being involved at a national level, Vermont's very local and very into local. And it's one of the reasons I live here. But there are things happening at the national stage that we need to, I believe, be really involved in. And so I just kind of jumped in with both feet. And I think that was where that came from.
And what's so great about Carla Hayden?
She's amazing. She, I mean, you were talking about Baltimore, right? When the Baltimore riots happened, she was right out in front sticking a "We're open for business" sign on the front door of the public library. And way back in the day when I was kind of a baby librarian in early 2000s, she took John Ashcroft to task because he was being a little grumpy about the Patriot Act and being like, "Where are our librarians? They're just being, you know, acting. They're in hysterics about the Patriot Act. We're not coming after your records. Nobody cares about you." And she was like, actually, That's not kind. And I think you and I should chit-chat about what's going on, because we heard what you said to the National Restaurant Association, and it wasn't cool. And they had a really nice conversation, and that actually was the beginning of some of the reforms to the USA Patriot Act about the involved gag order, so you couldn't tell people when the FBI had come in shaking up your library. And I think it was a combination of things, both sort of a level of class and decorum on her part, being like, no, actually, librarians are actually important, and you should treat us with some respect, actually. And also just what it did for, you know, the tiny libraries who are afraid. You know, the FBI comes to your library, that's scary. Even if you agree with every single thing they're doing, it's still a scary thing. And to have them be like, you can't talk to anybody about this besides your lawyer, scary. And maybe overreaching and not necessary. And so she, when she was president of the American Library Association, you know, stood up, called a meeting, handled it. And she's done a lot of – she's just generally been sort of a good egg in library circles. She helped the Baltimore library system get a lot more savvy with technology, ebooks and Wi-Fi and that kind of stuff. And personally, she's just a nice, warm, friendly person, which is, you know, a huge deal. You know, not – Billington wasn't warm and fuzzy, the previous Librarian of Congress, and you kind of got the feeling he was too fancy for you. And you kind of get the feeling that Dr. Hayden – could run a library for everybody in the country, not just her special people.
You know, you mentioned that she was active in sort of pushing back on some of the things that were in the USA Patriot Act, and you've been pretty active in that too, particularly in relation to the provision that allowed the FBI to search library records without a warrant and then said libraries can't tell the public or the people whose records may have been searched that they've been searched. And you printed out or created these signs and distributed them that say things that a library could actually say, things like the FBI has not been here, and then underneath at the bottom of the sign it says, watch very closely for the removal of this sign.
Yeah, those are, I mean, they have sort of a term now that I didn't even know at the time. They're called a warrant canary. So you can say nobody's been here, and then you can take down the sign that says nobody's been here, and that exists in a quasi-legal gray area where you're not saying they've been here, but you're not saying they still haven't been there.
Right.
And so it's not it's a little bit more of a theater than I think it's effective in a specific thing. But we're seeing more and more big corporations. You know, Google has a page that says this is how many national security letters we've been served, because it's not a search warrant where you have to go through a judge and people can see it. It's a national security letter, which is weird and quasi and secret and whatnot. And I think a lot of people felt weird about that, especially in the library world, where like our stuff is public. Our meetings are public. Our spaces are public. We are yours. And so having to keep this level of secrecy was sort of not cool. And so the warrant canary idea is a broader idea, and I just sort of brought it to bear on what I conceived of as this particular not awesome part, which actually isn't part of the Patriot Act anymore, that it was a lawsuit, the Library Connection in Connecticut. They sued. They won. Very exciting. I like to think me and my stuff was a very small part of that.
And I think the Vermont Library Association actually handed those signs out to libraries around the state.
The Intellectual Freedom Committee sent copies to every library in the state.
We got a tweet from Billsville House who says, Jessamine has been a library rock star since way back in the Metafilter days. Thanks for sharing all your knowledge. And we got a tweet from Rick Scully who says, Jessamine is awesome. Seriously, make sure you talk about moss, please. And you say on your webpage bio that one of the things you're into is moss, so you're going to have to tell us about that.
Everybody needs it's an offline hobby.
And yours is moss.
And mine is going out into the woods and collecting moss and building little moss terrariums in my house so that me, who travels a lot and doesn't have any pets or children, still has something I can nurture and take care of in my home.
And it's something that, you know, you're laughing about now with what looks like sort of a wry laugh, maybe a little bit of embarrassment, but clearly not embarrassing because you put it out there as something that you're really into.
Yeah, no, it's a thing I care about, but it's also useful to be able to be that XYZ person. Okay. So I'm like that librarian
that lady who likes moss, that person who lives in Randolph, the computer lady, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's one of my things.
What else is next for you in terms of pushing libraries into the future and pushing the importance of libraries moving forward?
Well, I'm sort of broadening my reach a little bit. I'm teaching an online class for the University of Hawaii's Library School graduate program starting next week, and we're doing a Tools for Community Advocacy. So really what I would like is for there to be an awful lot more people doing the kinds of things that I'm doing. But a lot of people need the toolkits, and they need to understand what that's made of and that it's a thing that they can do. We haven't always been out in front of issues like that in the library world, but I think we can be. And so spreading the word, doing that, in addition to teaching my HTML class at VTC, is sort of what I'm doing next. More educating and talking to more people about more things.
That's Jessamine West, an influential librarian, writer, and technologist who lives in Randolph. She spoke with host Jane Lindholm this spring on Vermont Edition. Coming up, caring for a loved one who has Alzheimer's. We'll talk with a Vermont writer who tells her family's story in a graphic memoir. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Patty Daniels, in for Jane Lindholm. A diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease is devastating for a family. But as in many life experiences, there can also be touching moments of love and awareness in dealing with Alzheimer's, and even humor and healing. Vermont writer Dana Walrath has lived that story with her mother, Alice, who has Alzheimer's. When Alice couldn't live on her own anymore, she came to live with Dana and her husband. And Walrath describes that period of time in a graphic memoir. She says her motives in inviting her mother to live with her were not entirely altruistic. Walrath hoped that living together, even as Alzheimer's was taking its toll, might help heal a rift she felt with her mom. And in many ways, it did. Dana Walrath is an author, an artist, and a medical anthropologist. And she was Jane Lindholm's guest this spring on Vermont Edition to talk about her book, Alice Heimers, Through the Looking Glass of Alzheimer's. Walrath explained why Alice in Wonderland was the metaphor she chose for explaining her mother's disease.
Because if you embrace the magic and the unexpected and you just let whatever happens, happens, it's a lot less difficult to deal with. I mean, obviously there's loss. Everybody feels that tremendously. But that sort of was our guiding principle, that we just had to kind of whatever happened, happened, we would do it.
So when I said you say that it wasn't just pure altruism that made you or spurred you to invite your mother to live with you. I mean, some of it was. You're taking care of your mom. So there is a lot of duty and filial duty and also this idea of wanting to care for somebody you love. But there was also this sort of feeling of unfinished business that you had. What was that about?
Absolutely. Though I have to say I didn't realize it until I got into it that there was unfinished business. I just kept on processing it. She's too well. She's got all her social graces intact. We can't put her in a lockdown unit, and that was her only option. She had been kicked out of her apartment and then kicked out of a senior living community because she kept on trying to wander. And
even, which is a typical symptom of Alzheimer's and dementia.
Absolutely. And so I had to figure out what could work for her and what could honor her. And it was a little bit crazy. I mean, people would say, are you sure you want to do this? And I just trusted a feeling that it was the right thing to do. And it was only months into it that I realized that she was there because of unfinished business. I totally expected her to go and live with my sister because they were very close. And she and I just kind of never made that sort of a relationship. So
maybe you could read a passage. There's a part of the book that sort of speaks to this. And, you know, it helps explain how you and she got at these questions of your relationship and your history together. And it's actually really through simple interactions that, you know, if you look at them on the face of them and they could mean nothing. But if you look at them more deeply, to you especially, they really mean something. Could you read a passage?
Absolutely. This Alice turned back, and I kept brushing, watching her through the mirror. She looked up and found my eyes in the reflection. I wasn't very good to you, I'm sorry. Unfinished business. That's one of the reasons she was here living with us, but I never imagined I would hear these words stated so simply. Thanks. So you forgive me? Of course. On an intellectual level, I had forgiven her years before. How come? because you did the best you could. But I knew that if I wanted it, Alzheimer's would let us have this conversation every single day. But forgiveness is also action, action that lets me redo the past. I wanted to stand at the same dressing table and brush her hair without yanking, without getting annoyed at her knots and chopping all her hair off. I wanted to listen to her as she spoke about her day. I wanted to guide her through uncharted territory. I wanted to face sickness of the mental sort straight on instead of sweeping it under the rug. The rhythm of the brush soothed us both. When I set the brush down on the dressing table, next to a bowl overflowing with the strands of beads that Alice loved to wear, she turned around to face me again and said, "Running a hotel must be very hard, Aliceheimer's."
You know, so in some ways you could say, oh, she doesn't even know what she's talking about when she says, you know, I wasn't very good to you. But what did you feel in that moment?
Oh, it was so genuine. I had just at that moment, she had asked me the question, "Dana, why are you so good to me?" And I said, "Because you're my mother." And she said, "I'm your mother? Who's your daddy?" And then when I explained it to her, she said, "Ah, yes, I remember." But in those months when she first moved in with us, she was, because I think one of the interesting things that can happen in dementia is people open up in ways. They might become more reflective. They let go of the social rules that kept them from going to certain places. And my mother, one by one, was going through things that she was feeling very bad about. So she had to talk about her younger brother who had Down syndrome and then was institutionalized and died there when he was about 10 years old. She had such guilt towards her parents who were both survivors of the Armenian genocide and that she hadn't visited their graves. So, you know, eventually she was going to get around to me.
What did she have to apologize for with you?
I think that we had one of those family dynamics where my mother was working her tail off to give us everything that she didn't have as a poor immigrant kid in New York City growing up. And so she was just exhausted. And she could sense that, you know, I could just take care of myself. And she was worried about my older brother who was struggling. And I sort of took care of myself. But that leaves you feeling like, hey, what about me or something like that. But I got that during dementia, which was fascinating.
But after that conversation, you didn't say, okay, great, now you can go live in New York with my sister.
No, definitely not. I mean, it really was true that the act of having her there gave me so many things. For example, I'm an artist and a writer now, but growing up, my mother would say, oh, you'll never get a job doing that. You should go to medical school. So during dementia, she said that she wished she had gone to medical school. And all of a sudden, everything made sense. And then she's looking around in my house at everything I had created and said to me during dementia, you should quit your job and make art full time. So dementia gave us an opportunity to meet as human beings. And so I really came to appreciate who she was and really appreciate how much she did, in fact, give me. So I think our families make us learn things.
I'm talking with Dana Walrath about her new book, Aliceheimer's, Alzheimer's Through the Looking Glass. And Dana, you are a writer and an artist, but you also did move into the medical field. You're a medical anthropologist. How do you think that framed your thinking on your mother's diagnosis and illness?
Oh, it was so useful. It just gave me a perspective that I could understand why we're all so terrified of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. What medical anthropologists do is they look at the cultural aspects of healing systems, and every single society has their own sets of beliefs and practices having to do with sickness and health. And we come from a society that believes in science. Our doctors' powers come from scientific research and so forth. And their main job is to prevent death and to cure diseases. And it's also a system based on a separation between the mind and the body. And it's a system based on numbers and all those kinds of things. And we think of it as science and fact, but it's really something we've all internalized as kids. So then come along and think about dementia. So it's a mind problem. We stigmatize mind problems in our society. It's at the end of life. and it ultimately leads to death. It is also a sickness that makes us more and more dependent. And we're a society that believes that independence is one of the most important things. And so put all those things together, and dementia terrifies us, and the end of life terrifies us, death terrifies us. And I look at other medical systems from other cultures where death is a much more normal part of life. And so I could very easily use that anthropological toolkit to say, okay, well, biomedicine's good, and my mother's really a great patient when we go visit the physicians. But what else can we do to make up for that stigma? So it was like a toolkit that I had.
You know, you mentioned that your mother would walk away from where she was living in New York, and that's one of the common symptoms of dementia. And another one is not understanding where you are in time and space. And so maybe you're living as a child, you're 10 years old, and you believe that you're a 10-year-old still. And your mother would have this idea that she was someplace other than the present. And how did you deal with that?
Oh, absolutely. That happened all the time. She'd come downstairs, oh my gosh, I've missed the school bus. And I'd say, no, don't worry, no school, you're on vacation. And my oldest son told me that that's actually using a principle from improv comedy called the yes and principle. So whatever the person does, you just say yes and you add to it. So yes, she thought she missed the school bus. No, you didn't miss the school bus, but I affirm the fact that she really was someone going to school. So we didn't challenge those things on a regular basis. And that tied back, too, to the anthropological training, because we, as anthropologists, we have to keep lots of realities in our head all at once. So it's the people we study, our own biases from our cultural backgrounds, our theoretical frameworks, and that just was so handy with dementia, because she had one reality, I had another one, and I could always make it safe for us to rejoin. And so the yes and, you know, if she'd be hallucinating, which she did quite a bit of, or she was someplace else and I was there, we just said, you are a superhero. You've got special powers. You can fly. You can see things we can't see. And that honored what she was experiencing, so we didn't have to get into fights about what she was experiencing.
Like she would say she could see your father in a tree, and your father had died years earlier.
That's exactly right. And so she saw him in the tree. Every time we'd go out for a walk, he was up there in the maple trees, and we eventually learned to use it. So we'd say, and this was with the help of another healing, other healing traditions. So as a medical anthropologist, my job at UVM was to bring, one of the many things was to bring alternative and integrative kinds of healing into the medical curriculum. And so when my mother was sick, I just took advantage of those different kinds of things. And Hakomi therapy is this method of understanding what people are experiencing in their bodies. And so Martha Whitney, a Hakomi therapist in Burlington, met with my mother and noticed that whenever she spoke about my father, she would look up and she'd put her hand across her heart. So then when she would say, where's Dave? Where is he? You know, I expected him for dinner or whatever. I could just say, put your hand over your heart and rub your heart and look up. And she would always say, ah, yes, there he is.
I'm talking with Dana Walrath. Her new book is called Alzheimer's Through the Looking Glass. Would you read another passage for us?
Absolutely. This is from Alice Ungrounded. On quiet afternoons at our house, you could hear my mother reading out loud to herself, her intuitive effort to bring the information in by another channel to make it stick. Witnessing this led me to revive the family bedtime story, a ritual that improved her sleeping and that helped me find our common ground. We started with Anna Sewell's Black Beauty. The first night she checked in about the voice, "Horses can't write, can they?" She listened with the rapt, wide-eyed attention of a child, moaning when any creature, large or small, was harmed. When Black Beauty struggled to be well-behaved, Alice whispered to her stuffed bear, "It's hard to be good, isn't it?" Alzheimer's.
There's a tenderness there, Dana, but I also wonder if it was difficult to in some ways be reversing your roles and reading to your mother as if she was a child and watching her have these sort of childlike reactions to things.
She was so genuine that it brought out tenderness. And I think that you know, we never have the privilege of knowing our parents as children. And I, through dementia, got to see who she was as a young person. And that was really a remarkable gift. It was something that I feel so lucky to have had, and sort of wish that when someone got the diagnosis of dementia, that a physician would say, hey, this is an opportunity. You can learn things about this person that you might never have known. So, and sure, it was in some ways strange to take on that role, but in other ways, it was the most natural thing in the world. She was a member of my family. I mean, there's a famous Billy Collins poem, The Lanyard, about how we can never, you know, really repay our mothers. But when you care for them at the end of their lives, you are repaying that.
That's Dana Walrath. She's a medical anthropologist, writer, and visual artist. Her book is called Alice Heimers, Alzheimer's Through the Looking Glass. It's a graphic memoir of her experience caring for her sick mother. And that's our program for today. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Our directors are Mary Williams and Liam Connors. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Patty Daniels. Thanks for listening.